Anxiety, depression, suicide, these have always been issues, but why are they so high among Gen Z? And what do we know about Gen Z? Are there any steps you can take to help a troubled teen, even if you're not a trained counselor? These are the questions Daniel McCoy recently got to ask Dr. Gary Zustiak, an expert in crisis counseling and student ministry. Dr. Zustiak has authored a number of books and articles, and he's the director of counseling and pastoral care at Ozark Christian College. Are you trying to figure out Gen Z? Do you have a troubled teen in your life whom you'd like to help lead to wholeness in Christ? Then you're going to want to listen to what Dr. Zustiak has to say. Let's listen in.
So we're going to talk about mental health, but first I want to focus somewhat on today's generation of young people. So first, how would you describe Gen Z?
Well, one of the things, the characteristics I'm going to share with you are ones that I have gleaned from James Emery White's book, Meet Generation Z, and Gene Twenge's book, iGen, and then just from my other just articles and things. So this will kind of be a broad overview taken from both of those very authoritative sources. One that really bothers me right now that I think is very apropos is a significant percentage of Gen Z embraces socialism. YouGov study found 26% of those between the ages of 18 and 39 have a favorable view of socialism compared to only 15% of those over the age of 65. So they're really open to socialism. And I think the idea of that comes out of the fact that to go to college today, most students incur huge amounts of debt. And that's very frustrating for them because then they can't buy a home. They don't feel like they can get married as soon as they want to and start a family because they have this huge debt. So the idea of free everything, free college, free healthcare is very appealing to this particular generation. Mm. 70% of millennials say that they would be somewhat or extremely likely to vote for a socialist candidate, according to that same YouGov poll. Another thing is Gen Z is Wi-Fi enabled. If you're familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, he places physiological needs as the most basic first need, things like food, shelter, water, safety. And then, you know, then you go up to love and belonging and, you know, transcendence is at the top. Well, I have kind of jokingly revised it in my psychology class. And rather than physiological needs is the most basic, I said Wi-Fi is their most basic need. Yeah, these kids, their cell phones are like an umbilical cord. They are never without it, and it is always on, and they are always checking it. And so that's one of those characteristics of Gen Z is they are, you know, Wi-Fi enabled, Wi-Fi addicted. They are post-Christian. 23% of Americans adults, a third of millennials, are what theologians, church growth people refer to as the nuns. Not like Catholic nuns, but, you know, if they're taking a survey and they say, what religion are you or what denomination, they would say none. They don't claim any religious identity at all. And there, a lot of Gen Zs are growing up in homes where there's no religion whatsoever. They've never experienced any type of church service or read the Bible at all. If you talk to a lot of the kids doing youth ministry today, they will testify that they are getting kids that are third generation unchurched. Mm. And they have no belief whatsoever, which is pretty scary for the church. I think that's something they need to pay attention to. And then it would follow if they have no religion, they are very secularized. Previous generations grew up at least with some the Judeo-Christian values of the past that were passed on to them, you know, by their parents, or they were aware of at least as a reference point. but today's generation has very little or no acquaintance with the gospel and Judeo-Christian values. Morals are just situational ethics. You know, everyone gets to determine for themselves what's wrong. You know, even it was Oprah Winfrey in some graduation speech told them to go out and discover the truth for themselves. Go find your own truth, which is, you know, very much a secularized idea. They've never seen the world without the internet. So they just have this, you know, addiction to texting and messaging. And they prefer that even over face-to-face interactions. And I'll talk some more about that, because that has had some very negative effects on their mental health. Mm. The fact that they prefer texting to face-to-face interaction. Gen Z absorbs tons of new information every day. They'll spend several hours a day social media, searching the internet for information. Not that that's bad, searching the internet for information. I mean, that's a wonderful thing. I mean, I do that. You do that, I'm sure. But the problem is they don't have the skills to be able to discern or to critique the information that they find, you know, whether it's legit or not, whether it's prejudiced information or not, whether it's biased information or not. They just don't have those skills. They just type something into Google and the first hit that comes up, that's good. And they'll just believe that. Another real
just what resonates? Is it just, well, this resonates with me, so I'm going to believe it?
Yeah, I think if they, yeah, when they hit it, they go, yeah, that sounds good. It resonates with them and maybe their experience. And it's like, yeah, that's how I think too. So got to be true, you know, that kind of a thing. Another concern, and this, again, is tied into technology, is they have seen a lot of porn, lots and lots of it. No other generation has had pornography so readily available, literally at their fingertips. Survey of college students in New England found that 73% had seen porn online before they turned 18. I think the average age at which a kid is exposed to porn is now 10 years of age. That's the average. So to make that an average, you know, think you've got some that are older, but there has to be a lot that are exposed to even a younger age. And then along with that is the whole phenomenon of sexting, you know, sending, receiving those sexually explicit text messages or pictures of yourself in various states of undress. Survey middle school age students, Los Angeles, 25% had sent or received a sext. Smaller study of college students found that more than half, 54%, had reported sending a sext before they turned 18. They just saw it as kind of a form of flirting. And then they're more accepting of sexual fluidity. Gen Z very strongly supports gay marriage, transgender rights. For them, those things are kind of just a part of everyday life. Be rare for a Z not to have a friend from the LGBT community. And then a 2016 survey, gender and sexuality. This is a new by Walter Thompson Company, a New York-based firm. They found only 48% of those 13 to 20 years old described themselves as completely heterosexual. And then you compare that to 65% said that those who were 21 to 34. So that's kind of just a quick overview for you of characteristics of Gen Z.
So we're going to get into kind of some of the mental health issues and the correlation with Gen Z. But before that, I mean, is there any hope there in all of the statistics? Do you see any reasons for optimism about Gen Z?
Yeah, absolutely. The first book I wrote was on Generation X, and pretty much everybody was writing off Generation X. I mean, you know, the term for them was slacker, you know. And everyone's real negative about them. But I saw a lot of positive things about them. I was very hopeful about Gen X, and I think Gen X has stepped up. I mean, these are your middle-aged parents now. These are the people that are contributing, doing stuff. They didn't turn out to be horrible. Even my generation, even though I'm a boomer, you know, I grew up in the 60s, and so, you know, I was a hippie. And good grief, all the older generation said we were worthless, you know, long-haired hippie freaks, and we'll be worthless. You know, God's still on his throne. And I think he has something to do for every generation. So I'm hopeful. There are a lot of positive things that I can still see about Gen Z. I'm not giving up on them.
Uh-huh. Very cool. Well, it seems like more young people today are struggling with mental health issues than I was aware of growing up. Is it true that things are worse now? And what are some contributing factors?
Yes, it is true that mental health issues, as reported by Gen Z and millennials, really have risen. I think the person who's done the most research on this is Jean Twenge. And in her book, iGen, she actually has charted this out as to when it first happened and when this first took place. But by their self-reporting, college students, there has been a 20% increase in cases of anxiety and depression. So there definitely has. It's been charted. You know, this new survey by the Pew Research Center, they found 7 out of 10 teens identify anxiety and depression as a major problem that they face. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 1 in 5 American children ages 3 through 17, that's about 15 million young people, have a diagnosable mental, emotional, or behavioral disorder in any given year in the U.S. But sad thing is, only 20% of those are ever diagnosed and receive treatment. So, you know, 80%, about 12 million kids, are not receiving any treatment for their depression and anxiety. And then that is then what has contributed for the rise in suicide among teens. Suicide is the number 2 cause of death among teenagers. More teenagers die by suicide than by homicide or shooting. And it's getting worse. It's reached a 40-year high of depression in teenage girls since 2015. It's just really has skyrocketed. And it's documented anywhere you go, any place you would ask, whether it's you know, the people and college students, their crisis counseling, teachers, they would attest to the rise in anxiety and depression.
So kind of a big picture question here, but is it possible to counsel a troubled teen in a helpful way, even if you're not a trained counselor?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, they've broken down a successful counseling encounter. You know, what's the most important thing? What helps towards a successful counseling encounter? And 30% of a successful counseling encounter is simply the relationship that the two people have with each other, the client-counselor relationship. And 40% of the success of that is the client's belief in the person who's helping them and the whole counseling process. 15% is their hope that they can get better, and only 15% is actually the particular type of therapy that someone's trained in. And so actually 85% of a successful encounter is basically the relationship. It's the relationship that heals. It's the relationship. Human relationships are the most powerful. It's the most powerful encounter that can actually change lives that we know of. So, yeah, even if you're not a professional counselor, man, just caring about kids and getting involved in their lives can make a difference. Now, with that said, you need to also understand that you might you might be working with some teenager who they are so depressed. It's a clinical depression. They also have suicidal ideation. You need to care enough to make a professional referral when that happens.
Let's talk about anxiety. Are there any practical steps to helping someone to reduce their anxiety?
Yes, there are things that you can do to reduce anxiety. And a lot of practical steps that you can do. Some of those are, first of all, you have to understand anxiety in terms of basically what causes that are what we call cognitive distortions or irrational beliefs. And cognitive distortions, Albert Ellis, in his rational emotive therapy that he developed, was one of the first ones to recognize those. And cognitive distortions are things like all or nothing thinking, black and white thinking, overgeneralizations, catastrophizing, minimizing or maximizing, expecting the worst, rumination. And any of those things, if a young person is engaging in those, it leads towards, you know, anxiety or depression. And what you have to do is to teach a young person to recognize these cognitive distortions, these beliefs they have about themselves that are not true, and how to replace a distortion with a realistic view. And you teach them how to catch the cognitive distortions, identify them, catch them, and then replace them with a realistic view. And what happens is when you replace a distortion with a realistic view, you are able to have a different emotional response to your thought. And so rather than anxiety, you can approach it in a calm, rational way. There's some physical things you can do. You can teach them to do what I call the deep breathing exercise. And you simply, sit with your hands on your lap and you breathe in deeply through your nose to a count of like three or four. And then you hold it to a count of three or four. And then you slowly exhale through the mouth to a count of three or four. And have them do that for just 3 or 4 minutes, and you'll be amazed at the physiological effect that has on your body. It really is very calming, and so that's one of the things that you would do.
Fascinating. Let's talk about depression. Are there any practical steps to helping someone to deal with depression?
Again, with depression, they can come from cognitive distortions. And so the same way that you would deal with them as far as anxiety, you do the same thing. And there are different types of depressions. One of the things you need to understand, there can be situational depressions, but there could be cognitive distortions, you know, your rational thinking that causes depression. There can be hormonal issues that cause depression. You'll see about this time of the year, we'll see cases of seasonal affective disorder, which is, you know, the sunlight works on the brain to produce serotonin, which is a natural mood elevator. And if people don't get exposed to enough sunlight, sometimes they will experience depression. And you can actually purchase special lights, boxes that they have these high intensity lights in them. You can place them at your workspace or where you sit, and that will help to alleviate some of the depression that is caused directly by seasonal affective disorder. Some specific things that you could do to help someone who is depressed, one of the things is to help them keep a routine and trying to get out of the house, even just for short periods of time. Deliberate physical activity is really important. If they can have some, even just a walk, a brisk walk for 25 minutes will actually produce, all right, some serotonin, some mood uplift there. Talking is always good. Just find someone who cares, who's a good listening ear. And, or if you're just too embarrassed to talk, then journaling is a good alternative. take your emotions and write them out on paper. If appetite's poor, try and make sure that they eat healthily. One of the things that is underestimated, the importance as it deals with depression, is sleep. You need to make sure you get a good 8 hours of sleep each night. And don't isolate yourself. When people tend to isolate, those cognitive distortions tend to increase and they ruminate, and it's a downward spiral. So make sure they are reaching people, reaching out, telling people that they need to talk, find someone who's a good listener.
Yeah. Let's say you know someone who is suicidal.
Yes.
What steps do you take?
There are some very specific steps that you want to take with someone who's suicidal. Standard protocol across the United States that's being taught is called QPR. And QPR is kind of like CPR. You know, CPR, people are trained how to, do the chest compression so that you can keep someone alive who's having, a heart attack, a physical crisis, until the medical professionals arrive. Well, QPR kind of is that same way. The Q stands for question. If you suspect that someone is suicidal, you need to ask them the question, and that is, are you thinking of dying by suicide? Are you considering suicide? Are you thinking about killing yourself? Now, you don't just ask that just right straight out first, but one of the things you can do is pretty much everyone who is suicidal gives clues that they're suicidal. And so there's behavioral clues, their hygiene starts to go bad. They start giving away prized possessions. They start isolating themselves. They start talking about themes on death and how they'd be better off. The world would be better off if they weren't there. So there's direct verbal clues. They would say that. There's indirect verbal clues. There's behavioral clues. You just need to be able to pick up on the clues that someone is suicidal. And you would say, hey, I've noticed you're not yourself recently, and you have even kind of mentioned that maybe everyone would be better off if you weren't around. And so because I care about you, I need to ask, are you thinking about suicide? And you have to ask that question. Now, as soon as they, and if they answer yes, then what you need to do then is to persuade them, and this is the P, persuade them to wait until they have tried one other thing. And the persuading them is to persuade them to talk to someone who is at a crisis center, someone who's a professional counselor. Mm-hmm. And you persuade them just to wait, to put it off, just hold on until we can talk to someone else who may be able to make the pain go away without such a, radical decision. And then the R is you make the referral. Mm-hmm. And you can either take them personally to a crisis center or to an emergency room in a hospital or to a professional therapist. And if they don't have one of those, you can call the national hotline. The National Suicide Hotline is available 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year. The number for the National Suicide Hotline is 1-800-273-8255. And what I do is if I'm with a person who's in crisis and we call the number, I tell them I'm calling on behalf of a friend and I'm going to put it on speaker so that I can hear what the crisis interventionist is saying that needs to be done. And then you follow through with that.
What would you say to someone who says, I've got a therapist, why would I need the church? Why would I need Christianity?
Well, I would say it's not a matter of either or. but a matter of both and. I highly support the use of a therapist if one is needed. But there are some issues that I believe in terms of mental, emotional health. The basis of those issues is a spiritual issue. Psychology is wonderful in a lot of ways. I mean, it helps us to understand human behavior and thought processes. But one of the things that psychology cannot do, it cannot tell us the meaning to life. It cannot give purpose to living. I believe only God can do that. Forgiveness is best understood and experienced through an understanding of what God did for us through the death of Christ on the cross. And that enables us to forgive those who have hurt us. And so there are so many issues that I believe have deep spiritual ramifications that have to do with emotional, mental health, that people need to address that part of themselves.